Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. Why are citizens willing to fight and die in some wars, but not others? What are the implications of that for political leadership and for war and peace more generally? My guest has been deeply studying these questions. Hein Hommantz is a professor of political science at the University of Rochester. His previous work includes two books, War and Punishment and Leaders in International Conflict. Professor Hommantz, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Grant.
So let's just start with the beginnings. Tell me how you got the idea to conduct this particular new set of research that you're looking at.
Well, in my dissertation, I basically started thinking about war from a different angle by starting to focus on how wars end rather than how they start. And because don't forget, you know, the first shots of the war don't really explain much. You know, if we explain the first day of the First World War, we don't explain why 20 or 14 million people die. We have to understand why wars go on. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that leaders play an essential role in making wars start and in making wars end. And when I was done with that project, I was, of course, very much deep into the salt mines about what actually happened in the war, and I read the memoirs and lots of details. And I was just deeply touched by the individual bravery, sacrifice of millions of people who went to fight and die at the front. And there's some really fantastic literature on this. For example, Alistair Horne's Price of Glory, 1916, which describes the lives of individual soldiers and what was going on in the First World War in kind of some detail. It makes it very gripping. Mm. So it was a natural question to think like, okay, in international relations, we talk about why do states fight? And I wanted to raise the question, why do leaders fight? But that leaves the essential step unexplained. Why do the individuals actually go to the front and do the fighting and the dying? Because it's not the leaders that do.
So your focus in exploring this question, if I understand it correctly, is on territorial conflict specifically.
Yes.
So fighting over land control.
Yeah.
Why do you want to make that your focus?
Because the territorial conflicts are the most severe, most deaths, and they last the longest. Hmm. They're, in a certain sense, we can say the most important. They stand out from the rest.
Well, we'll go into some of the details on your findings here as we work our way through the conversation. But let me just ask you then, as also another preliminary question, give our listeners an overview of what your central findings are on this question of why some wars, not others.
Okay, well, I'm trying to sketch out a kind of conceptual framework. And if you look closely at wars and think about them deeply, you see that most wars are not wars with a Hitler in there. You know, the thing that is striking about Hitler is that he had more or less unlimited aims. He wanted anything he could get his hands on. You know, he conquered West Europe and then went east. But that's not typical at all. Even though we think of wars in terms of the Second World War, most wars are for very limited and specific aims and very specific pieces of territory, which of course raises a question immediately. Not so much as like, why is there a war between Grant and Hein, but why do Grant and Hein dispute this piece of territory but not other pieces of territory? Mm. We think in international relations typically about wars between two countries, but we don't think about what is the specific issue at stake. Why do you fight for this territory and not that? So that's how I started thinking about the whole process of war in a kind of a broader way. And I've written some papers and published some work on this, and it's pretty clear that indeed that most wars are for limited aims. And if you look carefully, for example, to a continent like Africa, the territorial claims there are not based on claims to natural resources like oil or gold. They're about issues of identity. And that is kind of linked then with political power. So that's where I started.
So then tell us why then citizens have such a greater willingness to fight for their own homeland, and not some other territory that they regard differently.
So the question then, as you alluded to, you built up to, is so what limits those claims for? Yeah. Then where do these limits come from? Are they just because you face a strong enemy and therefore you can't get more, but you would have liked it, or is it truly the case that if somebody offered you a piece of territory, you would say no, thank you, I don't want it? And I want to make the case that in most instances, it's true that if you were offered a specific piece of territory, you wouldn't take it. So take, for example, 1848, Mexican-American War. The United States defeats Mexico, occupies the capital, and doesn't claim the whole of Mexico. They only claim certain parts. And there's some specific reasons for that, partially about the danger of introducing people who were too different from the main body of the populace. There are some ideas of identity, of who are we and who are this nation, which limit sometimes the pieces of territory that you want, the pieces that you can assimilate easily, or pieces that, you know, are more sometimes difficult to assimilate. You would actually say, no, thank you, I don't want. And an essential part in that is this group identity that is taught and inculcated in school, and it is a geographic identity. It's an identity of the homeland is us, which is different from identities that we typically think of, which are identities by type, skin color, religion, mm-hmm. race, whatever, right? Those identities you sometimes can fake, right? I have an identity as somebody who wears glasses, but I can falsify that by wearing contact lenses. There's another form of identity which was, you know, recognized by the political geographer Robert Sack, a brilliant man, that you can actually create identities and categorize by area. You can say the people over here are us and the people over there are them. That's the principle of territoriality, a strategy based on exclusion by area. And that principle can be used to help construct a group identity.
You're listening to WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with University of Rochester professor Hein Hohmanz. So that, to me, the way you just described it then, would lead, at least in my thinking as I'm understanding it, to a preference among citizens for, or a willingness, let me say, to fight in what are primarily defensive wars, right, rather than offensive wars, or no?
Well, that's a tricky question, because that turns out to be kind of a matter of definition, right? If I define my homeland to include the literal province, that's Bolivia and Chile, even though Chile controls it, is that an offensive war or a defensive war? Hmm. It depends on the underlying first definition of the homeland. And in some cases, particularly if you look at South America, almost every country says that it lost territory. Well, that can't be true, right? Some clearly gained territory while other people lost it. And those lost areas are often said, like, we have to reunify the homeland. And to my great surprise, I find some instances where people are willing to pay an extraordinary price to maintain that claim. Let me give you an example. In the 1990s, natural gas is discovered in Bolivia, which would add a ton of money to Bolivia, to the GDP. We're talking 5-6% or something like that. That's a lot of money. But they have to export it. They can export it north to Peru, but it costs $600-700 million pipelines, and the oil companies don't want to pay it. The alternative is to ship it to a gas pipeline that goes through the province they lost, the littoral province, and then out to the sea. And the president says, oh, maybe that's a good idea, and we do it. The people remove him from office. He's actually basically forced out, because they feel that that strategy, exporting through the gas pipeline to the lost province, would actually legitimate Chile's control and sovereignty over that area. Hmm. The Bolivian people, not just the leadership, the Bolivian people are willing to give up 6% not to own the territory, to maintain the claim.
So there are the cases where conflicts abroad are framed by leaders as efforts to protect the homeland, and you kind of intimated that before, that why some things are seen this way and others not. I mean, you could even say that the United States fighting in the Middle East sometimes gets framed that way. We're it's part of homeland security what we're doing. So how is it that citizens decide this? How is it that they decide what constitutes the homeland and when a conflict actually is protecting that?
Well, to respond to the, you know, something in the middle of the question you phrased, it's interesting that homeland is invoked in conflicts in the Middle East, because that's a principle that everybody more or less agrees that you should fight for. Even though control of oil wells in Syria really is not about protection of the American homeland, if you phrase it like that, you tap into that well of emotion and emotional support. And these homelands, I say, are not so flexible. It can't be the case that a leader just says, look, here's a homeland, and tomorrow I change my mind of what the homeland is. Because if you would do that, then individuals would know that it really doesn't have any force or binding power. He's just making it up, and they're fighting for his, you know, for his self-interest. So what I argued is these homelands get taught in school, and they get taught in school textbooks with maps. And this has been a deliberate strategy in many countries, and particularly in Latin America, since at least the late 19th century. Shall I go a little bit deeper into this
for
a moment?
Sure, yeah, yeah.
So think about the colonial empire of Spain that falls apart as a result of a couple of independence wars and fights and among local factions. And they fall apart into what? And how does each group claim to have its own state and its own territory? Supposedly, there is this legal principle, uti possidetis, that, you know, you fall along, an empire falls apart along the seams of the internal administrative frontiers. But there was no map agreed with those internal administrative frontiers. So these guys have to figure out what is the territorial extent of their nation. And remember, there is no good cartography. You know, people haven't explored the inside of the Amazon with kind of triangulation and detailed map making. So there's these groups that form and they try to claim some kind of authority over some territory, and they want to inculcate some loyalty to their state. And the problem then that you face is all the people were Spanish speaking, they all had dark hair, they all had olive complexion, and they all were Catholic. So since everybody had that in common, you can't use that as a distinction to build a national identity. Instead, and this particularly was the case in Argentina pretty early on, they use geography education to inculcate a sense of national identity, where the map played an essential role. This is us, that's them.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Hein Coumans. He's a professor of political science at the University of Rochester, where he studies international conflict. So, Hein, you were talking about this in the first half of the program. Wanted to come back to it. But it's this notion, again, of what kinds of claims will the citizenry buy and which ones they won't from leaders about what's homeland and all and what's not. What about the issue of claiming new territory, entirely new territory, as rightfully theirs? How does that play into your analysis here?
According to my understanding and logic, that should be very difficult to do. But you can understand that leaders sometimes have incentives to do that because there may be an ethnic group there that would vote in systematically in their favor. So the example that comes to mind is what recently happened in Syria with Turkey's invasion of Syria. And I wasn't really that surprised. Because I've seen maps, I've traced maps from Erdogan and Turkey in the last 5-6 years, where the map of Turkey on those maps doesn't correspond to, you know, the map that we would use in a Western or kind of Google Atlas. So there were some claims made for territory on that map that I thought, like, what is this guy up to? According to my understanding and my argument, as I said earlier, the leader can't just change overnight the map and everybody will buy it because it's too different. It would take at least a generation or 15 or 20 years for people to really buy into that. The question here that I just don't really have an answer to at the moment is how extensive is the use of maps currently and those quote-unquote wrong maps in Turkey and in Turkish media? This seems to me a good indicator for how serious Erdogan's claims are.
So let's go back to the United States and let's think about the Middle East again. President Trump has repeatedly said that he is loath to send U.S. troops abroad for any major new commitment. And he also has said that he wants to bring most or all of the remaining troops in the Middle East home, although, you know, we still have a presence there. How does that dynamic fit with your analysis, that whole discussion about how we are seeing our presence in the Middle East and how President Trump is envisioning that going forward?
Well, this raises a couple of really interesting issues that I think are worthy of some more serious thought. I mean, you know, it's very sad to say, but it's undoubtedly true that the war in the Middle East at the moment and the American effort is not seen as a national effort. It's a small, you know, conscription army. And many people can go their daily lives without recognizing the sacrifices that these people make. And I bet that few individuals are actually aware of the sacrifices they make in paying higher taxes to pay for these war efforts. So this is a kind of an odd kind of war or ongoing process where it's not the entire population that is necessary to support this. Still, in this situation, the administration or any administration talks about defense of the homeland to motivate some sacrifices. But this isn't a kind of a maybe we are in a new era of warfare where we no longer rely on conscription armies and massive domestic support in order to fight. If that's true, that would be very, very worrisome to me, because then many of the gloves of war and the constraints go out the window.
In terms of the constraints that come from the countries themselves?
Yeah, that comes from, you know, like, what can I ask my people to fight for? Mm-hmm. Well, then anything. If the people really don't feel they're fighting for anything, you can send soldiers to, oh, let me just make it up from the top of my head, Greenland, and occupy it, right? In the world that I think of, it's like the age of conscription and mass armies, which required mass support and mass taxes, there were certain limits put on leaders to deploy and use these armies. You can only use them for goals that the majority of the citizen would support.
Mm. And so what do your findings say about civil wars? Because those are often the bloodiest of all conflicts. So there you've got groups within a geographic area fighting over that map itself or how that map is going to get carved up.
That's a great question. So I'll be able to have an answer in about a month and a half.
Okay.
Because I'm doing an experiment where I ask people in Chile and Argentina and in Colombia, I ask them a question, though, if there's a threat to the fatherland, you know, how much are you willing to sacrifice? Nothing, higher taxes, suffering, or my life. I've done this experiment in Bolivia where it turns out that 63% of the Bolivians say, I would be willing to give my life. Hmm. But then I treat the other half of in the experiment by showing them a map of their country. And then in Bolivia, that 63 went up to 71%. So just the priming of the map created this group, you know, group identity, triggered this group identity, and increased willingness to fight and die for the country. So I'm doing that experiment in Chile and Argentina, and I'm doing it in Bolivia. In Colombia, which is, of course, is super interesting because we have the FARC there. We have the underlying conflict, perhaps with Venezuela as well. We have the competing rebel groups. So it will be really interesting to see what is going on there. Do the rebels still identify strong with the national state and the national territory, or do they say, like, we want to be different and separate? I don't know. It depends also on what kind of education the FARC actually offers. Do they offer a national education? Do they claim they want to take over the state? So to piggyback on this to maybe in more detail and to get maybe to the heart of the question you raised, these secessionist movements and these civil wars where groups want to secede, they almost always revolve around pre-existing administrative units, not about the ethnic and demographic pattern of a certain group. It is the political administrative unit that is being proposed to secede. So this coordination, this loyalty among these territorial units, even there plays in the central role.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking of the conversations that you hear in the United States now and again about states seceding. I don't think it's entirely serious, but those are all along the lines that you say. It's administrative units that are driving that. California, you know, is going to secede from the Union.
Well, Quebec wanted to secede,
right.
And then they gave them some English-speaking territories to buy them off. And then they said later, well, we want to secede again. Well, then, you know, only the French-speaking parts. No. We want the English-speaking parts because it's the administrative unit, right? So you got to take those claims. You got to look a little bit deeper in what those claims mean. And there is something about this territorial organization into some kind of administrative units, partially because you can actually enforce laws. There is something to this territorial organization which is very powerful.
Something else that popped into my head as you were talking about the mental maps then that people learn. And I'm thinking about the Civil War in the United States in the 19th century, it wasn't all that long ago that there was still quite a striking regional difference in how that war was called which evokes a map. One, the Civil War. The other one, the war between the states.
Or the war of Northern aggression.
Or Northern aggression, if we're going to take it even
further.
Well,
let me pose you this example, just this interesting article that I just read by Mishra and Mishra. It's called Border Bias. So I'm going to, listeners, I'm going to do an experiment on Grant right here, right now.
Uh-oh.
Okay, Grant, which city is more Western, Reno or San Diego?
Well, I would think San Diego.
You're wrong.
Okay. I figured I was wrong because that was the obvious answer. So.
Well, no. Cause
but I didn't want to try to game your question.
Because so, the trick is there. We place these cities in
California.
In the states. Yeah.
Interesting.
So just for the listener, we place them in the superordinate category of the relevant state. And so Reno is in Nevada, which is more easterly to California.
Right. Interesting. If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is University of Rochester Professor Hein Humans. So let me ask you this question. Are there lessons here, do you think, for understanding an even prior question, which is why these territorial conflicts arise in the first place or become so intractable that they lead to warfare? I mean, there are other ways of dealing with territorial conflict. So is there something here that actually takes people to the edge and over the edge of saying, okay, you know, this is going to be a war?
I think, and I tell my students this, and I tell my colleagues this, I think that educators, both in elementary and high school, but also in academia, have a large burden to bear here, because a lot of people systematically falsify maps and publish them, and those can be used for other purposes. I think we should insist on correct maps. So if somebody like Erdogan starts publishing maps of Turkey which claim more territory from Turkey than she currently controls, we should point that out, and we should make a stink about it, because I think that's a danger it's a predictor, in my opinion, of conflict, and I hope to do more research to see to what degree that actually holds. It is this education that we use to inculcate group identity, which is fundamentally important. You know, if I believe that only people with purple noses are my in-group, then I will fight for people with purple noses wherever they live. We, as a society, and for good reasons, construct these group identities in our schools. And these have good side effects and bad side effects. We construct them because we live in an industrial society where we have to have a standardized human being, where everybody speaks the same language, everybody has a basic set of skills, and we can put one person in the factory and then rotate him or her out and then replace him or her with somebody else. Somebody that we can rely on more or less what their behavior will be under certain circumstances. That's what a group identity does. It gives you some kind of set of rules how to behave. An American and a Dutch person may solve a problem very differently and look at the other askance for saying, well, why do you do it in that weird way, when these are just two different solutions to the same problem? It's not true that one is inherently better. Just one culture adopts one set of rules and another one adopts a different set of rules.
So we've only got a couple minutes left, but I also want to at least touch briefly on some of your earlier work.
Yes, so
you have two previous books, War and Punishment and Leaders in International Conflict. And what you looked at there respectively, which you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, was the role of leaders in terminating war and in initiating war. So this idea of terminating war is particularly interesting. Can you just tell me what your main findings were in looking at how leaders terminate war and what lessons come out of that?
So the thing that struck me, I alluded to earlier in this interview, that we study typically war and then the first shot fires and then we say, okay, and then we pick it up when the last shot is fired. But, of course, all the action is in between those periods, right? The people die not in the first day. They die because wars go on so long. So if you look, for example, at the First World War, there's a cabinet meeting of the German chancellor, the Bethmann-Hollweg, the Emperor Kaiser William the Last, as I like to refer to him, and there's Falkenhayn, the chief of staff, and there's the cabinet And this is on 17 November 1914. That is almost exactly 4 years to the date before the war ends. And in that cabinet meeting, everybody agrees that Germany cannot win the war.
Hmm.
They already know it then. So why do they fight another 4 years? And the reason is pretty straightforward. They're afraid of a revolution. And they're afraid that they will be swinging from the lamppost personally themselves. I mean, Ludendorff, who later becomes very important in the First World War, is so afraid that at the end of the First World War, he puts on a false beard and a wig and flees to Norway. These people were terrified for their own skin. So they fight in the hope that they can pull some miracle out of the hat and win. And in the meantime, of course, they have to lie to the people and say, we're winning, we're doing great, we're winning. Because if the people would find out that they're not winning, and the only reason they're being asked to suffer more and die more is that to maintain and prop up the old order, they would revolt right now rather than wait until the end of the war.
So briefly, we only have a minute left. How do we then get to the termination of that war now that you've explained to me what's propelling it? How do they decide, okay, this is it?
What happened in the First World War is that Bulgaria and Austria-Hungary crumbled, and then the people knew the war is over. Then the leaders could no longer lie and tell them, oh, we're doing fine, we're winning. Then it was clear that Germany was losing. And the Germans then said, like, we're not going to fight anymore. We start a revolution now, which is exactly what they did. And, of course, to try to bite it off, at the very last moment, the Kaiser tried to, you know, open up some democratic reforms, but it was too late.
That was Hein Humans, Professor Humans. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
It's been a lot of fun. Thank you, Grant.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Associate producers include Sarah Forland and Zane Aga. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit us online at wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations or download the show as a podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.